From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Tiburon.
Sausalito.
Japantown, San Francisco.
Berkeley, California.
Coming up, we'll ring in the political new year with columnist Dan Walters.
Schwarzenegger really wanted to change the world. I mean, he had these big ideas of change. Jerry Brown just wants to balance the budget and escape with his life, I think.
Then we'll meet a recent college grad who's taking his job search to the street.
Whatever it takes. That's what I keep telling myself. I mean, a lot of people probably think I'm crazy, but I'm not.
And we'll speak with an icon of protests past about the Occupy movement of the present.
You know, we're concerned about buying a house. Now people have a concern about losing their house. We're concerned about whether we were going to be able to get into school. Now they have a concern about whether we're going to be able to afford to go to school.
The man who raised his fist in defiance at the 1968 Olympic Games, John Carlos. That's all today on Cross Currents. It's a new year, and time for a new legislative session. And that means a new debate over how to address California's budget problems. When they reconvene this week, lawmakers will try out solutions involving everything from legalizing online poker to scuttling high-speed rail. Last week, the California Supreme Court ruled that the state can eliminate redevelopment agencies. It's a controversial move, but Governor Jerry Brown says it will raise close to $2 billion this year alone. I asked Sacramento Bee political columnist Dan Walters to talk me through some of the new developments in California's budgetary thinking.
Apparently the strategy he and the Democrats in the legislature will pursue is to do a budget that says, if you pass the taxes, we'll do this, this, and this. If you don't pass the taxes, we'll, won't do this, this, and this.
So what are some of those triggers?
Well,
what
we
are
don't,
things that be taken away?
We don't know what those triggers are going to be for another week until he releases the budget, but undoubtedly they'll involve schools. And undoubtedly involve public safety, because those are the things he says are most important, but those are also the things that are most popular with the voters. So undoubtedly the triggers will involve those two issues particularly.
And you found that California currently actually has, and this was interesting to me, the nation's fifth highest state and local taxes already, before any measures would be passed.
Yeah,
it's
like
about 9.5% of residents' personal income.
Yeah, you have to put those together because different states divide up responsibilities differently. And if the governor, to put it in some sort of context, if the governor's proposal was passed, another $7 billion, it would add, you know, give or take, 0.5% to that 9.5% and bring it up to about 10, which would be right up there with the big boys like New York and New Jersey and Connecticut and the few states that are above us.
Well, there's only four other big boys then.
Yeah, there are four other big boys.
One of Jerry Brown's recent victories was shutting down redevelopment agencies around the state. What kind of impact is this going to have in different regions?
Well, it's going to hit particularly hard on localities that have relied particularly heavy on redevelopment. And so it's going to hit some of those cities that are heavily invested in redevelopment extremely hard.
One of those cities is Oakland. They apparently could lose up to 171 workers, including police officers.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I haven't looked at a city-by-city survey. I know San Bernardino has a particularly heavy reliance. Now, those cities in which there's no redevelopment or where redevelopment's a fairly small part of the overall structure of the city, the effect is going to be quite minimal. So it really is going to vary a lot from community to community.
And, of course, this isn't going to mean the end of redevelopment. It just means the end of the agencies.
No, it means the end of redevelopment, probably, unless it's reconstituted. As it stands, redevelopment ends. There is no legal authority for continued redevelopment operations in California as of this moment.
Well, what about all these areas that have been considered to be blighted in different cities? How
will
they be dealt
with? Well, the existing projects will continue until they expire, and of that $5 billion, the state's probably going to recapture less than $2 billion of it. The other $3 billion is going to be used to pay off the debts that redevelopment agencies have run up. Incredible amount of debt. Over $100 billion worth of debt that agencies have run up, and that's double what it was 10 years ago. And it's going to be very traumatic in these areas, in these cities I mentioned earlier, that are heavily involved in redevelopment. You mentioned Oakland. It's kind of ironic that Oakland will be hit so hard, because when Jerry Brown was the mayor of Oakland, he was a big redevelopment fan. Now that he's governor of California, he went and did away with it.
That's Dan Walters. He's a columnist with the Sacramento Bee. How do you find the legislature working under Governor Brown? Obviously, he still needs to run tax measures by the voters, so they're stalemate with Republicans on that front. How about otherwise?
That question presupposes that the legislature is working, doesn't it? I'm not sure that that's a valid assumption, to tell you the truth. In fact, one could make the argument just to the opposite. It's not functioning any better than it did under Arnold Schwarzenegger, if truth be known. Yes, the Democrats have a little more authority because they got a Democratic governor. Some of the Democratic interest bills, particularly for unions, get signed that weren't signed before. But in the macro sense, in terms of a functioning body, the legislature is not any more functional than one under Arnold Schwarzenegger or Gray Davis or P. Wilson or George Dickmason or maybe Jerry Brown the first time around. It is a troubled and dysfunctional body for some systemic reasons.
Well, and recently you gave Jerry Brown an A for engagement and effort in a column, but a D or worse for results, which you also, for that matter, gave to Governor Schwarzenegger when he was in office.
For a first year, yes. Because neither of them, they came into office with similar expectations, which is, gee, I'm here, everything changes. Mm-hmm. Well, just because you're here, Jerry, just because you're here, Arnold, that doesn't mean anything changes. It basically is a recipe of failure. We've taken the idea of checks and balances in California and put it on steroids and effectively give every stakeholder in every issue a veto power.
Well, because of that systemic endemic problem with state government, and you've spoken about that for many years, it must be kind of frustrating for you as a columnist, actually.
20-some-odd years now I've been writing about that.
Is there anything that Jerry Brown can do in 2012 to earn a better grade?
I think he would have to acknowledge the dysfunction and say, I will devote my governorship to making it functional. He's trying to get around the dysfunction, essentially, by going to the voters, but that's exactly what Arnold Schwarzenegger tried to do as well.
And failed, generally.
And without success. And Jerry, I think, in some ways, has a more limited vision than Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger really wanted to change the world. I mean, he had big ideas of change. Jerry Brown just wants to balance the budget and escape with his life, I think.
Dan Walters is the political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. How would you fix California's budget problems? Join the discussion on our Facebook page, where KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. As state legislators debate the budget, many state residents are looking for money of their own. More than 11% of Californians are unemployed. It's one of the highest rates in the country. And many of those people have been job hunting for a while. Youth Radio's Sarah Quevedo met one recent college grad who's taking his job search to the San Francisco streets.
Alexander Monsanto has achieved a lot of firsts. He's a first-generation American, the first in his family to graduate high school, and the first to get a college degree. All eyes are on him to succeed, but it's been 10 months since he got his accounting degree from Florida Atlantic University, and still no job.
There are times where I would question what I was doing. I studied accounting for 4 years. If it's going to be this difficult to get a job, is this a field that I want to be in?
Month after month, Alexander Monsanto emailed resumes and wrote cover letters. One morning, he says, he responded to every Craigslist ad in the San Francisco Bay Area that mentioned accounting and didn't receive a single response.
It turns into like this vicious cycle where it's not helping to stay home to look for a job. You kind of have to just get out of the house and go and network, put yourself out there. I needed to find something different.
It's 7:45 in the morning, and the lanky 25-year-old boards a commuter bus to San Francisco, holding a sandwich board with the words, "Hire Me," spelled out on the front with big black sticky letters. Monsanto steps off the bus, pulls the straps over his shoulders, and begins walking the streets of the financial district. His "Hire Me" sign beats against his chest with every step. It's a moment that he says fills him with embarrassment every time.
Whatever it takes, that's what I keep telling myself. I mean, a lot of people probably think I'm crazy, but I'm not.
Not crazy at all, because it actually works. Monsanto says he gets twice as many interviews with his sandwich board, 3 to 4 per week. After a few blocks, his embarrassment fades. People wish him good luck and smile. At one point, Kim Tobias passes by. It turns out she's a corporate recruiter who wants a resume.
I think it's, a little wacky, but I think that it would work. Shows me that he's really interested in finding a job. He's got initiative. That's even better than LinkedIn.
A few blocks later, a woman calls out to him, "Hey, you in the sandwich board?" Janet Myers works at the University of California, and she has a tip for him.
Check out the UC website. They're looking for like a bunch of accounting clerks to do part
really?
Of the grant process. Yeah.
The University of California?
Yes.
Are you with UC?
Yeah, I am.
Can I use you as a referral?
Sure.
All right. UC.
While he scribbles down the job details, Eric Schroeder, a senior VP at the insurance giant Aon, pulls out his phone and snaps a picture, promising to post it on his LinkedIn profile.
Here's my card.
Do you want a copy of my resume?
Please.
Yeah, all right. Here you go.
I'm going to post it on LinkedIn and just say, here's an enterprising young man.
One of Monsanto's favorite stories is about the day he met his potentially perfect match. Representatives from the solar company Sunrun were on the same street corner in downtown San Francisco, wearing T-shirts with the advertisement, "We're hiring." Susan Wise, a PR manager at Sunrun, was stoked about the chance encounter.
Here they were proactively seeking job seekers, and they bumped into this guy who was doing his own little guerrilla marketing thing for seeking a job.
Monsanto followed up with a resume and even landed an interview, but no job.
I think what happened was just the opportunities we had listed weren't really a fit for his background. But I think it's a good example of how the concept of a mutual fit is tremendously important.
With so many mid-career job seekers competing for the same positions, it's hard for newcomers like Monsanto to be that perfect fit employers are looking for. So forced to face the reality of paying bills, Alexander Monsanto has put his dreams of a full-time accounting job on hold. Instead, he's willing to accept a part-time or even temporary job as an accountant. And in the meantime, he keeps beating the streets in his sandwich board.
Do you know anyone who needs an accountant?
No.
No?
Creative idea, though.
Yeah.
For Cross Currents, I'm Sarah Quevedo.
Sarah Quevedo is a reporter with Youth Radio and TurnstileNews.com. What's the craziest thing you've done to get a job? Tell us your story at 415-264-7106. It's 415-264-7106. Might hear yourself on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. In the past few months, many Americans dealing with the difficult economy have taken part in some of the largest domestic protest movements in recent history. What began as Occupy Wall Street spread from coast to coast. Demonstrators protested economic inequality and injustice, foreclosures and bank bailouts. It could all be summed up in one rallying cry.
We are the 99%! We are!
But if Occupy had a slogan, it doesn't necessarily have a moment, one image to define it in people's minds. And that's something that separates it from other big movements in our past, like this one from 1968. It was the 200-meter dash at the Summer Olympics in Mexico City. San Jose State University student John Carlos took third place to fellow American Tommy Smith. When they stepped to the podium to accept their medals, they raised their fists in a Black Power salute. The result was a scandal and an image that became iconic to the civil rights movement.
Based on the fact it was the greatest Olympics of all time, based on the fact that it was the first time the Olympics was in Technicolor, based on the fact that the Olympic Games was shown around the world for the first time, all of the components came together to make this a remarkable statement to society in terms of saying we can do a better job.
That's John Carlos. Now, more than 40 years later, he's become very involved with the Occupy movement, speaking at General Assemblies and participating in actions around the country. I sat down with him to ask him why he got involved with this movement.
Because I felt it was necessary. You know, I didn't get involved here in 2011. I got involved in 1968, you know, 43 years ago. The same fight that they have today is the fight that we had back then. Only difference is that the base have gotten bigger, you know. And in other words, in the 60s, we were concerned about people of color that was having a rough time economically or socially or politically or in housing or medical. We were concerned about education for those individuals back then. And now the circle has grown immensely to the point where it affects all ethnic groups now, irregardless of what your ethnic background is. Even go so far as to say, irregardless of what your nationality is, because this Wall Street is occupying the world right now. Everyone is concerned about the same issues that we were concerned about then. You know, we were concerned about buying a house. Now people have a concern about losing their house. We're concerned about whether we were going to be able to get into school. Now they have a concern about whether we're going to be able to afford to go to school. We was concerned about finding a job. Now they're concerned about finding a job. And not only that, they're concerned about the fact that they keep getting these letters in the mail talking about pay your student loans. So many of those concerns are the same concerns and maybe have an attitude to it. And it looks like to me, if we don't have Occupy the World, so to speak, it looked like places that I've gone around the world and saw where they had castles with gold on them, marble walls and marble floors and gold chandeliers, and come outside and walk 2 yards and they got little sugar shacks and shimmies all around this area. And it looks like if the people don't stand up, I could see America becoming that way one day as well.
That's John Carlos. He's co-author of the new book, John Carlos, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. Bring me back to that moment at the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City when you and Tommy Smith raised your fists in the air.
Well, it was a very energetic, high-intensity situation from within the field and in the stands. And then at the same time, the competition was enormous in terms of the competitorship, the greatness of the athletes that was there in those particular games. And then at the same time, we had overhead the swirling of a potential boycott that was still in the minds of many people, although we were at the games. And then, boom, here Tommy Smith and John Carlos get together and put our minds together and feel that, hey, you know, the fact that the boycott was called off, we felt it was necessary to still make a statement for the concerns that we have for society.
Knowing that this is going to be watched by so many people, did you have any idea about the significance of that through history?
I think I had perspective from the time I was born into the world relative to, you know, the idea that I had that I could make a difference and people could respond based on what they see me do. Because I've been doing things just like that all my life. It just so happens that the Olympic movement that I became involved in was such a spectacle that it was seen around the world.
Let's look ahead now to what's going on here with the Occupy movement taking place all around the country and around the world. You've become involved with that. As you say, you've been kind of involved with that throughout your entire life. What do you see as the similarities or differences between the development of that movement and the movements that were taking place in the late 60s?
You know, we had a concern in the 60s as, like I say, people of color. That concern has multiplied to the point where it's not just people of color anymore. It's people of the world right now that have this concern, whether it's in Egypt, whether it's in, you know, Afghanistan, or wherever the case may be. Many people right now are looking for social justice. They're tired of dictatorship. They're tired of the Big Five controlling and running their lives.
But do you see the way that they're manifesting their protests then being different or similar to the protests that took place in the 60s?
Well, anytime you come together unified, it's the same. It's about unification and having an understanding that we understand what we're fighting for. We understand who the enemy is. But I see these individuals stopping by Occupy when they get off work or when they're out to lunch, stopping by to look for 15 minutes or 20 minutes as to what's taking place. And I realize through this 15 minutes or this half an hour that I'm in the same boat as these people here. I might have a job, but my job is threatened. I might have a union, but my union might be gone tomorrow. I might have a house, but my mortgage is up for foreclosure. So many of these individuals are there watching, and every day they come back is building courage for them to say, I'm going to walk into this soup bowl. I'm going to eat the soup that these people are eating because I have a full understanding as to why they're out there now.
That's John Carlos, co-author of the new book, John Carlos, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. Where, being a lifelong activist, would you think the Occupy movement should go from here? How should it develop?
I think, first of all, we need to develop a line of communication to the point where we have one blanket statement that represents all of us from Wisconsin to New York, from New York to Oakland, from Oakland to Egypt, to the point where we all are on the same page and they can't use us or fragment us to the point where they say, well, you guys are different than what's happening in New York. Your fight is different, or your fight is different than what's happening in Wisconsin. We need to line ourselves up and have a steel fence in front of us to say we are one and the same quest that we have. I think that's the biggest thing that we can do. The second thing that I think is we have to understand that we're in this game. Now, how do you go about winning a game? You have to know the game rules in order to be a winner. For instance, down there in Oakland, when they took that trash bin and they took it and put it out in the center of the street and created this fire 8 feet tall, game rules state, now we have probable cause to come in and crack your head or crack anybody's head because we went against the game rules.
You mean the police had that?
The police. Mm-hmm. That's the attitude that they have or the government had. But yet and still, those individuals that was at Davis, when they sat there, humble, peace-loving, you understand, on their knees, sitting there, never created a ruckus, and then you see the law enforcement go and spray them with the mace or the pepper spray or what have you. That sends a signal to the world that these individuals didn't break no game rules. They didn't do anything wrong other than to have the opportunity to express their First Amendment rights.
That's John Carlos, co-author of the new book, John Carlos, A Sports Moment That Changed the World, the sports moment being the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City when he and Tommy Smith held their fists up in solidarity for human rights. So one thing that strikes me in talking with you and why I'm really interested in talking with you about the Occupy movement right now is that your book is The Sports Moment That Changed the World. It is an iconic moment in protest history, in the American history of protest. The Occupy movement doesn't have such a moment. It doesn't have an identified leader like that, like you. Do you think that it needs that kind of moment?
Well, the identified leader in the Occupy movement would be the Occupy movement coming together as one, as I stated earlier. It don't have to have a figurehead.
Would it be just more powerful if it did? If it had a Martin Luther King Jr. who was leading the way?
I don't know if it was as necessary saying they have to have a leader, per se, as long as they have the same line of defense. You understand? Because that in itself, that statement, Occupy, and they say Occupy Wall Street, or Occupy Oakland, or Occupy San Francisco. My attitude is Occupy the world. And that in itself sets a consensus for all the people to realize that this is a universal claim that we have. It's not one individual or one state or one city that has this vibe and this feeling that now is the time for us to step up because enough is enough. No one individual can carry that load. It has to be all the individuals to come together to be one individual to carry that load.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, stay in the fight. Stay in the fight. This is not a fight that we're going to lose or win overnight. This is a fight that's going to be long gone on. It's a fight that our kids are going to probably have to endure. You know, like we had a discussion last night at Laney Junior College, and we were sitting back, and I remember Angela Davis making a statement about the fact that when we were there in the 60s, we thought that based on this fight or this war that we had, this thing will be surpassed in another 3-4 years and we will change the world. Here we are 43 years later and we're still at the same level, but with the same level we in, there's still more people that's conscious as to what we need to do as a people to change society, whereas before that time maybe we didn't have that nucleus that we have today.
That's activist, former San Jose State student, and 1968 Olympic track medalist, John Carlos. His new memoir is The John Carlos Story. Find more information at our website, kalw.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Hanna Baba, Julie Kane, Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Casey Miner, Erica Moo, Rena Palta, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Alexander Victoria. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to City CarShare, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City CarShare is on the web at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll look at how county and state legislators are dealing with a controversial oil extraction process.
You know, it doesn't make me feel better to know what's going to poison me. You know, I want the poisoning to be stopped before it happens.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The song you're hearing right now is by Garen Benfield. He says his current sound might best be accompanied by a candlelight and a bottle of Pinot Noir. They don't offer either at the Dolores Park Cafe in San Francisco, but that's where you can hear him this Friday, starting about 7:30 p.m. It's an all-ages program. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney. This far away place. Well, I'm told I've done some living. I heard them say I made it back, but I can hardly see your face.